$3 to $5 billion to get to Nome.
Contemplating a road through Western Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 15th of September. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a plan from the federal government to respond to climate change.
The Department of Interior must continue to respond to the energy and climate change challenges, which I consider to be the signature issues of the 21st century.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by BP, teaming up with Alaskans since statehood and together looking toward a bright future. And by Alaska Communication Systems. ACS offers high-capacity, high-speed bandwidth for business with speeds up to gig E, connecting companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world.
The state has narrowed its options for a potential Western Alaska road link. The Department of Transportation began looking at the project again a year ago. It reviewed past studies, updating them with current cost, maintenance, terrain, resource, and community information. DOT Northern Region Planning Director Jerry Rafson says two potential routes stand out.
A northern route, which seems to provide more benefits to the mineral development, mining resources, and a Yukon River route, which provides more benefits to the communities. But it also provides benefits to some smaller type mining operations, the placer gold type operations.
Rafson says the envisioned northern route would take off from Bettles and head west to Nome, while the Yukon River Road would go either from Manly or Nenana to Nome. Rafson says cost estimates are commensurate with the mega scope of the project.
$3 to $5 billion to get to Nome.
The northern route would require about 440 miles of road and cost about $3 billion, while the Yukon route would traverse as much as 500 miles and run $4.5 to $5 billion due to more challenging terrain along the river. Rafson says either project would likely be built in stages over many years. The village of Tanana at the confluence of the Tanana and Yukon rivers would be on the path of the southern route. City manager Bear Ketzler says there's local support for a road link.
The tribe now has a roads program, and they had to do a prioritization, and it was very clear that in the top three priorities for the community is a development of the road to Tanana.
Ketzler says a road link could also result in resource development and jobs for locals. Rafson says economic factors have broadened villagers' interest in Western road access.
Communities are out there just hanging on, by a shoestring, a lot of them. They don't have a local economy. There's a very high cost of energy. There's a very high cost of goods, getting to town, for routine things, medical services, that sort of thing. I mean, costs are very high, and a lot of people see this as a way to bring those costs down and to reinvigorate their communities.
Rafson says the northern and southern route options will be presented to the DOT commissioner later this month. He says a more thorough examination will result in recommendation of a single route. The Parnell administration gave legislators today a comprehensive comparison of possible routes to get a long-lasting supply of natural gas to Anchorage, Fairbanks, and points in between. The 43 pages of maps, photos, and cost charts was part of a complete analysis due next spring that will fuel debate and decisions on in-state use of the state's North Slope reserves. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Harry Noah, the administration's in-state gas coordinator, was hired earlier this year to sort out the ideas and arguments coming in from various agencies and stakeholders for an in-state natural gas project to pipe natural gas to the rail belt. He's put together a management and engineering team and kept legislators up to date on their findings. The in-state project is only a backup to be used if what's called the big project, the gas line through Canada to North American markets, falls apart. The latest study, sorting out the possible routes and alternatives that a gas line could take, is only a small part of the information that policymakers will have to consider if an affirmative step is taken. NOAA said the bottom line is getting a price that consumers will pay and shippers will sell for. He said it's a dance.
So it comes down to the cost of the conveyance of this pipeline. And there's only two ways to drive that cost down. Either you increase the volume or the state participates in it. And those will all be your decisions. We're basically the mechanics trying to lay out a project and to see if we can tee up a project that's economically viable and can work. Our sense is that we can.
The general driving force of the development, which would be turned over to a private owner-operator, is to have gas flowing in Anchorage and Fairbanks by 2015. To get there, the state has to start getting permits now, starting with the Army Corps of Engineers next month. NOAA's team has to finish its feasibility study in June, and the owner would need to be chosen in early 2011. Anchorage Democrat Les Guerra said the Canadian line would be cheaper and would provide cheaper gas, but there's a risk the state might not get it. He asked when the decision is due to proceed with the plan that NOAA's putting together.
This whole thing obviously is a chicken and egg, right? If we knew we had the big pipeline going, we wouldn't be doing this. And if we knew that we could get cheaper cooking like gas, we wouldn't be doing this. And it's obviously frustrating and complex.
NOAA agrees with Guerra. There are too many factors at play that are not under the state's control. He says the best thing that lawmakers and the administration can do is put a project on a schedule.
And every 3 months, look over and say, are we drilling a Cook Inlet? Is somebody actually finding some gas? Or is the big line, is anything changed? Are we really on a schedule type thing? And be prepared to slow down. But if the only thing you can do is this, and put it on a schedule, and then constantly analyze what's happening around you, because everything else is out of your control.
The study of the in-state route favors using the Parks Highway as a reference rather than the Richardson Highway. It's 92 miles shorter, nearly $500 million less expensive, and with the military and utilities in the area, it would use more of the gas along the way. NOAA points out, though, that he will not make the decision. Legislators and the governor will do that, based on all the other studies that will come out between now and June. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
The Interior Department is opening 8 regional climate change response centers in the country, including one in Alaska. It's part of a new effort to coordinate the department's work on climate change. Interior Secretary Ken Salazar signed an order yesterday intended to address the impacts of climate change on the country's lands, waterways, wildlife, and cultural resources.
The Department of Interior must continue to change how it does business and to respond to the energy and climate change challenges, which I consider to be the signature issues of the 21st century.
As part of the new plan, Salazar will head a climate change response council made up of each of the Interior Department's assistant deputies and bureau heads. The department includes the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the National Park Service, Fish and Wildlife, among others. Salazar says they often work independently of one another.
The time where this department operated under silos is a time that's over. What we do now within our National Park Service needs to be connected up to what we're doing with water and science and USGS and Bureau of Reclamation and what we're doing with the wildlife refuges of the nation. So the creation of this council will ensure that we have the across-the-board approach to dealing with the challenges of climate change and new energy for our country.
The Climate Change Response Council will meet in the coming months to decide where in the state to base the Alaska Center and plans to announce its location by the end of the year. Interior Department Science Advisor Dr. Kit Batten says Alaska is critical to the department's work on climate change.
Alaskans are already experiencing the impacts of climate change at twice the rate of other parts of the world. And so these significant impacts, in a way, unfortunately, Alaska is experiencing first and foremost. And so as this place where we have so many different resources that the Department of the Interior needs to protect in terms of natural resources, cultural resources, clean water, it just makes a lot of sense to have one of these centers placed in Alaska.
Batten says they're also concerned about climate change impacts on Alaska Native communities. The eight regional centers will be funded by $10 million in the president's budget through the U.S. Geological Survey. The Interior Department hopes to build on that money and get more funding through the budgeting process for its overall climate change initiative. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a frightening encounter with a charging brown bear.
I feel like I'm in a National Geographic special, with the bear's cheeks flapping as it's roaring at us.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the District of Oregon has set a deadline for filing claims for anyone who has suffered injury by sexual, mental, or physical abuse or misconduct by a Jesuit priest or others, claiming the Society of Jesus Oregon Province has some responsibility. The deadline is November 30th, 2009. Proof of claim forms are available online or by calling 1-888-909-0100. This message is sponsored by the Society of Jesus Oregon Province.
The Anchorage School District is working to hire 53 new teachers and staff to help with more than 500 students who enrolled unexpectedly this year. The school board voted unanimously to approve the hiring of 30 teachers and 23 support staff last night. Superintendent Carol Como says she doesn't know why so many students are attending Anchorage schools. Last year, the district saw an influx of families moving in from rural Alaska, but Como says students are arriving from the lower 48 too.
We know there are many people moving to Alaska looking for jobs, and frankly, the permanent fund dividend seems to be a draw for some families, even though they have to live here a year. So we're seeing a combination of that. We're trying to determine if there are other reasons for this increase. I don't know if people are coming back from private schools. I don't know what they are, and that's what we're looking at over the next couple of weeks.
The district has experienced 2 years of significant growth in its student population, but Como says before that, the numbers were heading in the other direction.
We had been going down about 150 students a year for 5 years or so. So we were on that trend, and then all of a sudden last year, when the energy costs went up so high and people started moving into Anchorage, we saw this huge in-migration. So we're watching this very carefully to see if this is a short-term trend or if this is going to be the pattern of more people moving into Anchorage.
Como says the district should be able to fill most of the positions by the end of the month. In the meantime, she says substitutes are helping fill in the gaps. The district serves nearly 49,000 students. Wrangell residents descended on shops in town last weekend to take advantage of tax-free day. Shoppers enjoyed the luxury of stocking up on food, clothing, and other items without having to pay the city's 7% sales tax. KSTK's Tony Gorman has more on one of Wrangell's busiest shopping frenzies.
The cash registers were alive last Saturday as opportunistic shoppers poured into downtown Wrangell for tax-free day. The city and borough of Wrangell and the Wrangell Chamber of Commerce designate 2 days out of each year where locals can shop till they drop without worrying about the 7% city tax. Jeff Angerman is the owner of Angerman's Incorporated, an outlet store, which sells a variety of men's and women's apparel and sporting goods. Like many businesses on tax-free day, his stores offer many deals along with a tax exemption.
We have a lot of items, you know, our Columbia Sportswear, all of our new fall items are all on sale today. And in general, you know, it's only noon, and I'd say so far so good.
Down the street, Odyssey's True Value is packed with customers trying to get the best deals on hardware and supplies. Odyssey's general manager, Ernie Christian, says business usually picks up 2 to 3 times than normal on tax-free days. He says the discounts are the biggest draws.
Brings a lot of people out to save. 7% adds up, and then we also have other sales going on and items upstairs, so it's a big draw, and people really enjoy.
Groceries and other expenses can pile up while living in Bush, Alaska, so tax-free days can be a cushion of relief for most families like John and Cindy Waddington's. With a daughter at home, the newlywed couple took advantage of the case goods sale at City Market.
We did a lot of the case stuff with family members. We all pitched in together. And
like the bricks of cheese over there. If you buy them, they're $9, but if you get them by case, they're $6, so hey, it's a win-win situation with cheese.
Otter Pops, I think we have couple cases.
Five cases.
Another couple, Don and Tiffany Stevens, enjoy the fruits of tax-free days. They seize the days to stock up on winter supplies.
We got our paper towels and our winter food and stuff, and Lord knows I like to eat, so we got plenty of food.
Tax-free days have definitely had a positive effect on the community and the Southeast Alaska region. Shoppers have come from Petersburg and Prince of Wales Island to reap its benefits. Chamber of Commerce Director Tiss Peterman says the idea was presented to the Wrangell Assembly in 2006 as a way to encourage local shopping.
It took off. We started off with just one a year and had the approval of City Council, and it was so popular that in the second year we had approached City Council once again and got their approval to have two per year. And most of the store owners and people in the community really supported it.
Wrangell Mayor Don McConaghy agrees.
If you take a look, I've drove around town here two, three times now, and every parking spot is full. People are obviously in the stores and doing what it is that they do, as far as getting more expensive items, you know, larger ticket items, and I think it does the store owners just a heck of a lot of good.
The state of Alaska does not have a state tax. Like most bush Alaska towns, Wrangell has to rely on a local tax to bring in revenue. The borough's economy has struggled in recent times. A timber industry that was once strong in Wrangell has faded away. Fishing has also taken a hit in the last few years. McConaghy says he is indecisive over whether Wrangell needs more tax-free days to support its struggling economy.
Every time that we ever brought this up at City Council, I will flat out admit that I said, we are taking this straight out of the tax dollar of the city. And being that our city has to run on a budget, we have agreed to two tax-free days a year. I don't know that we need any more. Maybe we do. We'll see what happens in the future.
You won't hear most Wrangellites complaining about the two they have already. As far as they are concerned, they just live for the moment when those days come around. Reporting from Wrangell, I'm Tony Gorman.
The Homer City Council took its first public comment on the draft 2010 city budget last night. The city manager and council members have portrayed the budget situation as bleak since the first sales tax receipts came in earlier this year. But the council got some potentially good financial news on Monday. Homer could receive more than $1 million in punitive damages from the Exxon Valdez oil spill settlement fund by the end of October. Plaintiff's attorney Matt Jamin updated the council by telephone from his office in Kodiak. He said Exxon has agreed to pay interest in the case, clearing the way for a round of payments to qualifying municipalities.
What that means for the city of Homer is that a check for approximately $1.15 million should be available fairly soon.
However, anyone thinking the city of Homer could use the Exxon money to fix its budget woes got some bad news from Councilman Dennis Novak. He pointed out that the city council passed an ordinance in 2006 setting up a permanent fund for windfall money like the Exxon settlement. The money itself can't be spent this year, but earnings on the interest it makes will be available in the future. In addition, Novak said some Exxon money will be set aside for nonprofits.
5% of that will be the city's contribution, if you were, to the nonprofit investment fund, but it's not for immediate distribution. It's to generate money for future distribution.
Homer is one of 11 municipalities that will receive punitive damages from Exxon for the 1989 oil spill, still considered one of the worst environmental disasters in U.S. history. An Anchorage judge jury originally awarded plaintiffs $5 billion in punitive damages. The U.S. Supreme Court reduced that amount to $507.5 million in 2008.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
The state ferry Tustamina is headed to Seward for repairs. Alaska Department of Transportation spokesman Roger Weatherall says the boat's vehicle lift experienced an unspecified malfunction while offloading in Seldovia Sunday night.
Well, what that means is we don't know exactly what the problem is. We know that it's not operational.
to the point where, you know, we're allowed to sail. So we'll remain in port until the problem is remedied, and then we pass the Coast Guard inspection.
Weatherall says he doesn't have a timeline for when the Tustee will return to service, but he hopes it'll be soon. This is the second time in a week that the 45-year-old Tustamina has been stuck in port. Last Wednesday, a scheduled sailing from Kodiak to Homer was delayed for 24 hours due to high winds. An injured hiker who intentionally started a wildfire to get help was rescued by the National Park Service earlier this month. Denali National Park's spokeswoman Chris Pfister says a helicopter went after 39-year-old Robert Faber of Toronto, Ontario.
On Saturday, September 5th, our Park Communications Center received a report of a fire that was noted in the Sanctuary River drainage. This would have been about 10 miles south of the Denali Park Road. When we went to investigate, we saw someone waving on the ground. The ship was able to land, and they determined that this gentleman had taken a 20-foot fall the previous evening, lost most of the equipment, and he had fractures to his upper arm and lower spine.
Pfister says the injured man was airlifted by helicopter to the hospital in Fairbanks. It took 40 water bucket drops from the helicopter to put out the fire, which burned about 20 acres of dwarf birch in the Upper Sanctuary River area. Pfister says Faber walked 10 miles despite his injuries and will not be charged for the rescue or fire suppression.
We certainly don't encourage people to set fires, but in this case, he was in a pretty desperate situation. He was by himself. He was pretty severely injured. He had tried to get himself out and had tried to make people aware of his location, and this was a last-ditch effort, and there won't be any further follow-up on our part.
Pfister says the helicopter used in the rescue and fire suppression is stationed at the park as part of normal seasonal firefighting operations. A proper Alaskan summer includes plenty of adventure. The state's vast open spaces, abundance of wildlife, and rivers filled with fish make thrills easy enough to find. But those opportunities always come with a certain element of danger, too. As the season of sunlight draws to a close, APRN's Annie Feit is reflecting on a trip that quickly crossed the line from exciting to terrifying.
On a sunny weekend in July, my husband Dave and I set off on a three-day backpacking trip. He had scoured the Chugach State Park map and found a remote and challenging route that had us spending as much time on bouncy tundra above treeline as possible. Late in the afternoon on the second day, we descended a steep slope to a rushing creek and started talking about whether we needed to fill up our water bottles. I'll let Dave take the story from there.
I said, "There's a bear." But usually when I say there's a bear, it means there's a bear eating berries, or there's a bear a quarter mile away. But unfortunately, in this case, it meant there is a brown bear running as fast as it can downhill towards us.
And what did I do?
You looked up, saw the bear running at us, and started running away.
Which, just in case people don't know, is... Where does that fall?
It's not what you're supposed to do. In fact, it's really a hard thing not to do. And it was the first time either of us had ever seen a bear running towards us like it was about to eat us.
We both fumbled for our bear spray. As I was pulling it out of my pack, I looked back up and saw the bear lose its balance on the steep, rocky slope. One minute he was running towards us at top speed. The next, he looked like a cartoon bear rolling down the mountain. We were both thinking this was very bad news for us. Now he was going to be even more pissed.
We were kind of stunned and we lost sight of it for a second. And when we saw it again, it was getting washed down the creek backwards on its back over a bunch of big, huge boulders.
The bear popped out of the stream and continued charging towards us, but more slowly this time. Dave and I stood shoulder to shoulder, yelling loudly at the bear and doing our best to look big and intimidating. But we were no match for the bear.
I feel like I'm in a National Geographic special with the bear's cheeks flapping as it's roaring at us.
And what are you thinking at this point?
I was thinking that we are maybe going to die. Well, I was thinking two things. I was thinking that it's totally possible that this bear is going to come tear us to bits, and that at least I was going to die with you, and I was happy I wasn't just by myself. But I was also trying to remind myself that a huge percentage of charges are bluff charges, or that if it wasn't a false charge, he would get within 30 feet and we would shoot him with a bear spray and he wouldn't like it and he would leave. But mostly I was thinking we're going to be ripped to pieces in the middle of nowhere.
The bear had been charging straight at us, but when he was about 30 feet away, he turned slightly to one side. We then realized why he had slowed down so much. He was dragging both hind legs behind him, apparently paralyzed from the waist down. Dave said something like, "I think we need to get out of here," and we gathered up our water bottles and started quickly climbing up the steep hillside the bear had just fallen down. A few hundred feet up, I turned around and saw the bear lying flat on its stomach, legs and arms splayed out on the gravel beach beside the creek. That's when I started crying.
I had come to the conclusion that we were probably out of grave danger and, tried to comfort you and put my arm around you and say, "I think we're going to be okay. I think it's not going to be able to chase us up this hill." At which point it became clear that you were crying for the bear. And you said something to the effect of, "It's just so sad. We killed it. The poor bear is going to die because of us."
Which was true.
Which may well have been true.
We reported the incident to a park ranger, but don't know what happened to the bear. Later, we talked about whether the scare would change forever how we felt about the wilderness near Anchorage. But just 2 weeks later, we were out on another remote backpacking trip. A tiny black bear did get our adrenaline pumping, but as soon as it saw us, it took off running in the other direction. It was the perfect rebound bear. But still, Dave and I are both looking forward to the winter hibernation season a little more than usual. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Tony Gorman in Wrangell, and Casey Kelly in Homer. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences. The U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the District of Oregon has set a deadline for filing claims for anyone who has suffered injury by sexual, mental, or physical abuse or misconduct by a Jesuit priest or others, claiming the Society of Jesus Oregon Province has some responsibility. The deadline is November 30, 2009. Proof of claim forms are available online or by calling 1-888-909-0100. This message is sponsored by the Society of Jesus, Oregon Province.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.